today is what we, Pete and I are going to do a teaching call on the self-absorbed partner. And then next week for level one and the people who are just joining, I'm going to do two things. One is a comprehensive overview of the developmental model. And then also I'm going to take time at the end of that call to give you a tour of the whole website so that you really feel familiar, comfortable, and can hop around in there and use it in a way that will work best for you.
That's a treasure map for an unbelievable amount of information, resources, and answers to sometimes your more immediate questions. So it's just a great treasure map that Ellen will be leading you through.
And if you are new, don't worry if you feel overwhelmed by some of the things that Pete and I are talking about today. It will sink in as the year goes on, and the language and also what we're talking about will become, it'll start getting into your bones and you'll start using it more and more. I'll also stay on for a couple of minutes at the end of this call. So if anybody has an urgent question about the website, you're welcome to stay on and ask, but otherwise just hold it till next week and we'll do a thorough tour. So I'm going to start this morning with a quick summary of some of the issues that I already sent out in the videos and blogs so that I'm not making a total assumption that everybody has devoured all four of them. But then Pete and I are going to cover five main areas this morning. The first one being setting the stage for effective work with a self-absorbed partner and their spouse. Second will be integrating the intrapsychic split, and particularly the part of the split that supports the continuation of self-absorbed behavior. I'm also going to talk about working with the spouse or the partner on not taking the self-absorption personally and what the value of that is in terms of changing the whole system. Then we're going to talk about working with the couple to teach them how to collaboratively coach each other out of their self-absorbed pattern. And last, we'll talk about crafting homework that enables them to support the shift from a more greedy approach to life to more grateful, more gratitude.
And growth.
Yes.
So it's kind of interesting that when we teach couples therapy or when anybody teaches any kind of therapy, we can only teach it in a linear fashion. But yet, you know that when you are in the room, you will keep going back and forth between concepts, ideas, approaches, interventions, etc. So think about these five areas that Ellen just mentioned as overlapping rings, like in a Venn diagram, and that as you increase your skill as a couples therapist, you're going to move more fluidly back and forth and around those five areas that Ellen just described. So even though we can only teach these concepts in a linear way, sometimes it gives a part of our brain the false illusion that these concepts are discrete and they have boundaries and they're clear-cut. But the areas are not discrete, they're not clear-cut, and when you're really on your game, when you're functioning at your highest, you will be smoothly integrating these five and we're going to demonstrate this later, how you really can, in just a few paragraphs, integrate many of these concepts at one time. But that
and
challenge...
There are some times when it makes sense to do one of them before the others, which
totally,
we'll also talk about.
Totally. But it's that challenge. That's what keeps our work interesting and challenging.
So... A quick thing, as I was working on all this self-absorbed material, I had an interesting experience one morning in my neighborhood, which is I got up early, I went over to Starbucks and Safeway, and I was standing in line in Safeway, and a 30-year-old guy was in front of me in line, and he had fewer groceries than I did, and he said, "I want you to go first. Take my spot in line." And I smiled and I said, "Well, thank you. I don't really need to do that, but thank you." He said, "No, I really love putting a smile on people's faces. It makes me feel good." So that happened. Then 5 minutes later, I was driving to my tennis lesson, and a truck kind of blocked my view for a minute, and I started to go from a stop sign, and a guy in a red sports car, probably another 30-year-old guy in a red sports car, was starting to turn, and he saw that I had pulled out. He stopped. He gave me the finger. He yelled at me, and he said, "Who do you think you are getting in my way?" So I thought, wow, you know, just in a couple of, like in the span of 10 minutes, I'd had experiences of the two opposite ends of the continuum. And one of the reasons that we're talking about self-absorption is because it's more common than most of us might think. And it comes out of a person having a high degree of self-focus coupled with a low capacity to recognize and respond to their partner or significant others as a separate self. It's hard for them to recognize that the other person has their own thoughts, their own feelings, wishes and desires, and their own vulnerabilities. And I thought it was particularly interesting when I did the survey last summer of therapists. I had 200 therapists respond to the survey that I did, and 81% of those 200 said that self-absorption creates a problem for them in their couple's work.
Them being the therapist.
Right, them being the therapist. So a few headlines, again, on the self-absorbed partner is that they tend to indulge themselves often with things like food, alcohol, sex, relaxation, watching TV, whatever, and
think immediate gratification.
Yeah. And they have trouble giving when it's inconvenient for them. So as a result, they're rarely team players. And when they come to therapy, they really are not super interested in inconvenient personal growth.
That would be a new term.
Right.
Inconvenient personal growth. As though there is such a thing as convenient personal growth.
Sometimes we want it, you know, okay. And yeah, that's the difference I'm talking about.
But let me just interrupt and say one thing you said, Ellen, which is really important, which is a self-absorbed person will come in and say, "Yes, I am giving, and here are three examples of my giving." If you drill down, what you will discover is each one of those examples where the self-absorbed person was giving, they were giving when it was pretty easy or effortless or convenient. That's the distinction.
Now, the spouses who live over time with self-absorbed partners chronically feel lonely. Sometimes they're depressed. Sometimes they report feeling insignificant, dismissed, or trapped. And for some of them, their own self-esteem erodes over time because they feel so stuck and they feel so hopeless to change the system. Now, many times they don't have the words to describe why. Sometimes they will come in and say, "I'm just sick of my partner being so self-centered." But sometimes they're just flailing about in their unhappiness without being able to articulate very well the reason why. And they think often that the difference it's going to take is a change in behavior. And, of course, behavior change will make a difference, but it's not sufficient. And in order for the change to last, we're looking at really some internal intrapsychic object relations changes that then result often in a more natural flow of the systemic and interpersonal changes. A common thing to see, too, is if a lonely spouse tries to explain how the emotional disconnection feels to them, the self-absorbed partner usually will respond poorly. They'll personalize it, they'll feel attacked, they'll attack back, and discount the significance of that problem. And so the loneliness builds, the pattern builds, and usually it's the partner of the self-absorbed person who requests therapy. And sometimes, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of couples where the partner says no and we never see them, or the partner will come but is very afraid of being ganged up on by you and by their partner.
Which indeed often happens.
Yes, it does.
Which is why we're doing this phone call today.
So let's briefly talk about you, the therapist, and how they create problems for you. And I'm going to ask you if you have an answer to what I'm about to ask to push star 2 on your phone, because then we can bring you in for your answer. But think for a minute, if you're not censoring yourself, what are the thoughts and feelings that come up in you when you're working with a couple, one partner is very self-absorbed, and they come in and they're at their worst one day, and you're sitting in the room with them at their worst, and
and you're having a bad day, and inside you're at your worst.
Or even if you're not, but just what do you want to say, or what do you feel?
The very impolite reactions, reflexes, urges that you have. Now, it's really important, I think, to recognize this in yourself, your own countertransference, and recognizing it helps, because inevitably your countertransference will become an issue with these people. And what gets triggered in me is I get a parental response, and I just want to tell them to grow up. Sometimes I just feel like I want to smack them alongside the head, especially if they're just whining and sniveling and believe that they should not have to do anything to get a better response from their partner except to be gratified. I just want to yell, grow up. And I know it's a stupid reaction, but that's what happens sometimes. So I'm just really curious what your reactions are. And here's an incentive. The quicker you jump in and respond, hopefully the more it starts to break down the resistance from participating down the road. You get it out of the way, you're participating, and it makes engaging in future calls a lot easier. So, go ahead.
Yeah, so we have from Ontario, a new member.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, yeah, actually I have that exact situation that you just described. The wife feels totally insignificant, lonely, trapped, and emotionally disconnected. That was her first complaint in the first session. Today, actually, we have the second session. The husband has been defending, attacking.
So let's talk about you instead of about the couple. So what do you feel when you're in the room with them?
Actually, I feel confused. I didn't know who was saying the truth or not, because the husband was so convincing and presenting her as the one who doesn't really value or appreciate his efforts to please her. So, you know, I was confused.
So they present initially for you a very confusing picture, and you sit there and, you know, in fact, you could end up feeling like insecure even possibly about
what am I going to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's take Karen.
What happens for me is initially I want to say, what are you thinking, shake and all that, but because I'm not a confronter, I usually shut down at that point and start to feel really helpless. and then I'm just sort of, you know, it's not easy for me.
Hey, I really appreciate your saying that, because think about the irony. At one level, we're trying to help couples be more real with each other.
Right.
While at the same time, we're sitting on a load of stuff ourselves. It's kind of
ironic.
And then
ironical. I think, well, maybe that's helping me empathize with her, but what do I do with that?
Well,
and
that's exactly what we're going to talk about, is how you can express yourself in a really effective way. The important thing is knowing what you feel and what your reaction is, so that you can use it later on, and we're going to get to that in a bit.
Okay, I think it's Tom, is it, or Victoria?
Yes, Tom, yeah. Hi. Yeah, I want to say, I feel angry, and I want to say, shut up. Shut the fuck up, you know, it's like, and I guess because I don't say that, I often end up just being quiet myself and not knowing how to deal with that ongoing diarrhea of talking.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you. That's great. That's just so common for people to feel that way. And let's just do one more. And person who's in Fresno.
So that's me. I'm Lois.
Hi, Lois.
I had a couple like this in my office a while ago, and so the wife was really unhappy and started complaining. So I did find myself with that feeling bad, I think, for the husband, who was making a lot of strides towards a kind of out of dysfunctional ways of relating with her, to having lots of insight and caring, and she's turning it away at every offering. And so I thought that was sad. And so I found myself a little mad, then I got really kind of quiet in my spirit and also my voice. I started talking really quiet to her and just asking questions, qualifying questions, as to what would, you know.
Oops, sorry, I just muted you by mistake. But
what will be happening, you know, when things are better, and kind of what would.
So the reaction that the internal reaction you have is what? That you go, I'm not so proud of that reaction, but that's my reaction.
Yeah.
What would that be?
What is the response I had?
Yeah, inside. No, internal, the one that a lot of therapists are reluctant to say out loud. What do you feel? What do you think? What is your urge?
I was mad.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was mad and sad.
Yeah. Oh,
great.
Great. Good.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. And we're going to go on just because of time. But it's great to see so many hands up, so thank you all. And some of the problems that these clients present for you, the therapist, are that, you know, you feel mad, you feel like you want to spit something out that you don't give yourself permission to spit out. And the other thing that these partners often do is that they are masters at deflecting progress, at running circles around you, at diverting you, and taking you off in a direction so that all of a sudden you're thinking, God, I was headed this way, and now all of a sudden, how did I end up over here? And they're very, very good at that. And if you ask them to take a risk or to do something, often they'll say back to you, well, I'm just not comfortable with that. As if they should be comfortable when they're making really deep level significant change. So, and, you know, on the page for this call, I put the links to all the earlier blogs and videos. And in one of those, I talked a lot more detail about what makes these couples particularly difficult to work with. But one of the things that we are going to be focusing on as we go on is really you also recognizing the change, because it can be slow and there are milestones along the way so that you can identify, because often it's the therapist who has to hold the direction and hold the reality that they are indeed changing. Pete, are you ready to go on setting the
I phone? Am. I had to change phones because when I was on, I got an announcement that the battery was low. So we're now ready to set the stage?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Now, I have been putting more and more and more energy into setting the stage before we actually do work, to prepare them for what they can expect of me, what I would expect of them when they come in. And believe me, I have discovered I have expectations of them. And I think most therapists do, whether we recognize it, admit it, or get clear about it or not. I think we do have certain expectations for couples when they come in. So the first thing I do when they make a phone call to set an appointment, I get a quick headline, what's your situation? And then I ask them to go to our website and read a blog called How to Get the Most Out of Couples Therapy. And I say to them, it will give you an idea about how I work, what you could expect of me, and indeed what I would expect of you guys. And most of all, though, I want you and your partner to read this, because hopefully it will keep you from rehearsing your bad behavior stories about the other person so that it gets us off to a stronger start. So, and I say, in other words, your work the therapy is already started before we even meet in the office. So that's one way of setting the stage. And before you go there, actually, I would suggest you do your own copy first before you get influenced by what we have. Just write your own version of what they could expect of you, how you think the therapy might unfold. It's not an easy document to write, for sure. Took me a lot of passes at it before I was finally satisfied with what's up there. But give it your shot first. Then a couple comes in, and I say, my one social question is, do you guys find the place okay? And they always, if they say yes, I say, great, we're off to a good start. If they say no, we got lost, I say, but you persisted, you're here, we're off to a good start. Then I ask them how they feel about being here, even though we haven't done anything yet, but just the fact that they made the effort to be here and we're beginning a process. And what I'm looking for is if there is any really strong initial resistance to coming in either one of the people. If there's a lot of resistance in one person, like, I don't believe we need to be here, I don't want to be here, then I'm cautious in terms of working with that person to make unilateral changes in the first meeting. I'm just cautious. Doesn't mean I won't. Just means I'm cautious. Then I ask if they've read the document, and about 90% of the time they say yes, and I say, what stood out for you? And almost always now the response is, well, we can only change ourselves. We can't change our partner. I say, great, you got the essence of that document. Then I ask, and this is a question that a lot of couples, I think, a lot of therapists are reluctant to ask. I will say to the couple, what would make this session really worthwhile for you? What would make this session glad that you came today? What would happen when you leave, you'd say, wow, that was a really good session. Now, I think a lot of therapists might be reluctant to ask that question because the response they get from the couple might be impossible for the therapist to deliver. So they don't ask it because the therapist doesn't want to set themselves up. So I put in a qualifier. I say, what would happen that would make it really worthwhile if it could happen? It may not, but I'm curious. If it could happen, what would that be? And my initial catalyst for asking this question was this. I started doing it because sometimes after the first session, which I thought it would be impossible to do more or cover more or make a better session than we had. Oh, my God, and my initial sessions are always 2 hours. And I think supremely satisfied with what happened. And I would ask, so how'd you guys feel about what we covered today? I don't know what the percent was, but it was too many who would say something like, well, it was a pretty good session, but we didn't get to dot, dot, dot. And then I did my level best to avoid gnashing my teeth, arg, and groaning. So that's why I started asking the question and then adding the qualifier, if it could happen. Don't know if it will, but if it could, what would that be? And then I will really work to see if I could integrate what they're saying. But the more impossible the goal that somebody says what they want to have happen today, the more they tend to be on the self-absorbed continuum. When a request shows that there's little awareness that the other person is a separate individual, or the magnitude of the request is so enormous, it's really a high correlation with the self-absorbed personality. So I start to get that right away. For example, if somebody says, well, what would make this a really good day if I knew that I was just a priority to my partner? Or I just want to be respected. Or perhaps the most symbiotic expression of all is, well, what would be, I just want to be happy. That's it. I just want to be happy as a way of responding to that question. So that gives me a really quick kind of diagnostic about where that person is in their developmental stage. They have very little appreciation for what they're asking for and very little appreciation for what it will take from their partner to deliver what they want. It's more like I describe and then wait for the miracle. And then at some point, again, to get kind of a diagnostic question and learn about their problems without creating a lot of gloom, I will say this to the couple. I don't do this with every couple. It depends. But many times I will say it's typical for a person in my chair, the therapist chair, when a couple comes in the first meeting to say, why are you here? What brings you here? What are your objectives? How can I help? And I say often that question leads to an atmosphere of gloom because each of you start pointing fingers at the other one and say, this is why I am here and this is what the problem is. And you've just been ripped in front of a stranger, and that doesn't feel good by anybody. So I say, let's not go down that path. Let's do a different path. And this path will be diagnostic, and it will let me know. It's diagnostic in the sense that it lets me know how well you guys have been listening to each other before you got here, and that's really important. So I want to know how well you guys have been listening to each other, and here's what I mean. I will say, Charlie, what do you think the top three or four complaints are that Sue has about you? And Sue, what do you think the top three or four complaints are that Charlie has about you? And either it doesn't matter who goes first because you both get the opportunity to express yourself. So Charlie will say whatever he says, and then I will say, maybe you just are getting lucky in guessing this, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you that Sue is going to say, boy, you really nailed it, Charlie. You really nailed it. And the responses are anywhere from like a 5 or a 6 to sometimes a 10. Tens are rare, but sometimes I'll get a 10. And then I'll say, let's check it out. So let's ask Sue, how did he do? And if Sue says, wow, he did pretty good, I'd give him an 8 or 9. I'd say, wow, he has been listening. Now, the fact that he hasn't done anything about what he's heard is why you guys are here. But just the fact, Sue, that he has been listening to you and he's been hearing what you have been saying, what's that like for a part of you knowing that Charlie has listened? Almost always they will say something like, well, that feels pretty good. I'm glad that he listened. I say, now tell Charlie that it feels pretty good. And then they say, Charlie, well, I didn't know you were listening so well, and it really feels good that you heard me. And then I'll say, and again, the fact that he hasn't responded so well is why you guys are here, but it's really nice that he has really gotten what you have said. So two things have happened. One, I'm getting an understanding of what Charlie's problems are, but even better, he is not being defensive. In fact, he is getting complimented for being a good listener, and that totally changes the atmosphere in the room around, well, my partner does this, which is more traditional. So we're off to a better start. If Sue says, well, Charlie got, I would give him about a 5 or 6. He didn't get that much. He got some good ones, but he missed some. I'll say to Charlie right away, wow, is there any part of you, Charlie, that's interested in what you missed? I suppose I'll get somebody who will say, no, I'm not interested. But so far, everybody says, yeah, I am. What did I miss? Now the partner is filling in the blanks for how Charlie is a schmuck, but Charlie asked for it instead of the traditional way where he is defending himself when he hears about how he's a schmuck. And then we switch roles and do it the other way. So it's a way of starting to ask questions differently, setting a stage at the beginning of therapy that's a little bit more respectful, a little bit easier, and not quite so gloomy that everybody has been pounding on each other. Now, the other thing I do about setting the stage, and this goes a long way, and I've already done it at the beginning of this call. I like to explain what I'm doing and why I'm doing it to the couple during the course of our work. And I did this at the beginning of our call when I said, it would really be nice for you guys to express, where do you get stuck in your countertransference? And if you speak up, it helps you get over that initial resistance of jumping in, and you become engaged a lot sooner, and it will make participation hopefully easier down the road. So I give an example about, I give an explanation about why I am asking what I am asking, instead of just saying, so what do you guys feel when you're having a real struggle with self-absorbed people? So by giving the explanation about why I'm asking it, it makes it a much more collaborative process that I'm working with you, here's how and here's why I'm working with you the way I am. I have found that to be infinitely better when I'm working with couples, especially when we're stuck at an impasse. Sometimes I'll be really quiet and I'll say, I'm just being really quiet, trying to figure out what to do next. And I say, there's one or two reasons why I get quiet like this. Either I have no idea or I have 100 ideas and I'm trying to sort it out. And if I have no idea, I'm telling you, one will come to me. I'm confident of that. So that's setting the stage by explaining what you're doing and why you're doing it. Then I use the phrase a part of you, and that lowers so much resistance. Instead of saying to somebody, well, you're really being stubborn, if I say to them, well, right now it looks like a part of you is digging in your heels and being stubborn. If I say a part of you, it makes it so much easier for that person to hear and accept and not get so defensive. If I say you're being stubborn, they'll want to defend and they'll want to give me a yes, but, or justify or explain, da, 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 da. It just makes all my work so much easier by saying to a person, well, a part of you seems like dot, dot, dot. And then, and we're going to get to this when we talk about coaching, I get their consent for how to coach them and how they need to give each other consent for being coached. Hugely important when you make interventions. And then the last one, because we were pressed for time, is often I will preface my confrontation. And I will say something like, what I'm about to say, Charlie, may make you defensive, and it may seem like I am taking sides. Well, that's because I am. So it's understandable. However, I want to talk to a part of you about dot, dot, dot. So that's some of the issues of setting the stage. Am I on the next one, too?
You are, So we're going to move on to exposing the split, the intra-psychic split, because and we're going to focus very specifically on self-absorbed partners, and there is a part of the person who likes it the way they are and likes that and supports the continuation. So we want to be able to expose that and then begin to move towards integrating the split.
That's exactly right. And identifying the split really helps you work to integrating the split, and it sets the stage for you to work a lot less hard, deal with your countertransference, make them work harder, they feel more satisfied, and so do you. Now, I want to say, here's something about stretch goals, which is any goal where we have to really stretch ourselves to make it. Every time we set a stretch goal for ourselves, there will be another part of us that will resist or rebel against it. Classic think New Year's resolutions. Person says, okay, it'd be a good idea. I want to get into shape, lose weight. And, yeah, there are really benefits if I do that. However, almost always there will be another part of us that will say, that sounds like a good idea, but, dot, dot, dot. We all have yes buts to goals that stretch us. And it's even more, there are even more yes buts when somebody is imposing, demanding, or even suggesting a goal for us that we haven't chosen for ourselves. And this basically is the heart of the resistance in couples therapy, because the goals are suggested, demanded, pushed on the other person that they haven't yet chosen for themselves. Each partner has things that they want the other person to do, to be, their attitude, and then the yes buts will show up as a self-protection, They're lazy. They don't want to do it. It's not high priority.
And this is especially true with the self-absorbed partner, because that usually the therapist and the spouse want change in that behavior. So, Pete, you were going to give an example.
Yeah. Now, if a person didn't have yes buts, then you wouldn't be talking about this issue as a problem. So the yes buts are always there. Now, let's say that I've been working with a couple, and I've reasonably identified when and how each person gets triggered and how they trigger each other. And there are lots of ways that couples trigger each other. But I'm only going to take one pattern now of how a couple triggers each other, describe the pattern, and then offer a way through and a way out of this pattern. So I would say to Charlie, I'd say to both of them to start with, if the two of you want to break this cycle, and we've identified what this cycle is, if the two of you want to break this cycle, it's going to require each of you to do opposite things. Charlie, a part of you will have to exercise internal restraint to avoid interrupting your loud voice tones and the facial expressions of aggression. That part of you that escalates, Charlie, does so to get your way, to make your voice heard, your opinions heard, and prevail over Sue's opinions and desires. Now, Charlie, there are a lot of reasons why this escalation happens, but the result is tension and ill feelings between the two of you. So my question, Charlie, is wondering, is there another part of you, even a small part, that seeks a better long-term solution with Sue, which will increase the odds of getting to a better and more satisfying relationship for each? And doing so, this will create much more of an I-thou versus an I-it relationship, which I've explained before, the difference between I, thou, and I, it. What I specifically mean, Charlie, is that you would be applying some internal restraint for the sake of a bigger picture, and I can give you some techniques which will make it easier for you to do this.
So there's a lot of really important things in what Pete just said to Charlie. One of those is that Pete is naming a developmental task, the developmental task of developing internal restraint and managing his aggressive impulses. Pete describes the escalation that Charlie does actually in a very non-judgmental, kind of a non-blaming, non-shame-based way. Pete's almost talking like, oh, I'm just talking about another fact of life. So he makes it very difficult for Charlie to argue with him. And he even goes farther to say there are lots of reasons that this type of escalation happens. And so since Pete's already acknowledged that there are lots of reasons for it, it prevents Charlie from needing to go to a defensive place and makes it hard for him to argue with Pete. And when he talks about, is there even a small part of you that would like to have a better relationship with Sue, that does two things really quickly. One is it moves away from the stuff that he might be defensive about, and it's also very hard to say no to that. And Pete reassures him that he'll give him some techniques so that he won't have to do it alone. So in a very short period of time, he's defining a developmental issue, letting Charlie know that he can count on Pete's support and that he doesn't have to be ashamed of the self-absorbed part of himself.
And then we have Sue. So I will say to Sue, you have a different task. A part of you will need to speak up, take your foot off the brakes of expressing yourself, and that part, when you do that, will engage versus withdraw. Now, Sue, I also recognize that a part of you withdraws and disengages for many legitimate reasons. However, Sue, is there any part of you perhaps even a small part, that aspires to have a stronger voice, a voice to be reckoned with, a voice that represents how you aspire to be at your highest level, a voice that lets him know who you are. And, Sue, I will give you some strategies to make that happen in a little easier and a smoother way.
So again, with Sue, Pete has now identified a developmental task for her. He says to her, to change the pattern, you're going to have to engage rather than withdrawing, which is the very earliest pieces of differentiation for her, and Pete's laying that out. He's asking her, do you aspire to have a stronger voice? And he's giving her something to strive for, but letting her know that in striving for it, it's going to make a difference. It's going to make a difference in their pattern of interaction and in her being able to move towards the outcome that they would like as a couple as well. And so, again, it's very hard for her to say no to him.
That's exactly what I'm pulling for. I want to make it as easy as possible for her to say yes. Now, and also in what I was saying to Charlie and Sue, notice that there's a lot of overlap between setting the stage, coaching them, exposing their intrapsychic conflicts, as well as the system issues and what their tasks are. Now, many therapists will unnecessarily tackle just one side of the problem and hope they can just reinforce the part of Charlie who aspires to change. But if the change is a stretch, then reinforcing just the inspiring part is rarely sufficient, and often it's going to lead to a disappointing report in the next session. The person, Charlie, will either report he didn't do it, he wasn't congruent with how he aspired to be, or he did it so poorly that Sue is going to feel let down yet again. But in this whole process, I am being directive and leading, perhaps more than some therapists are comfortable with. But the intrapsychic split, using two-chair work to identify and clarify the resistance and help Charlie work cooperatively between his resistance and his aspirations. So here's how I might do it. I say, Charlie, in the chair that you're in, the seat that you're in, if you really were, or as you really do, follow through and you get outside of your own skin and you respond to Sue in a more understanding, impactful, empathic, supportive, even going out of your way when it's inconvenient for you to be responsive to her, what might be the benefits of change for growing in that direction? And so Charlie will start to describe the benefits of the change. I will amplify, I'll reinforce, I'll stroke him for that, and I'll say, great, great, great. Now, let's talk to your alter ego. There's another part of you, Charlie, which thinks, that's a pretty good idea to do those things. However, so Charlie, come over here in this chair, be the alter ego that says, you know, those were pretty good ideas. Those are pretty good ways, things to do. However, so Charlie, in this chair, fill in the yes buts, the however. And then Charlie starts to say, da, 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 whatever he says, like, well, why should I have to be the one who, da, da, dot? Why should I have to? I don't want to. I'm already doing a lot. I don't get credit for what I do. And so you get all the self-protective defenses, all the rationalizations from this chair over here. I say, great. Now come back over here, Charlie, and respond from the part of you that aspires to make the change. And each time I ask him to shift, I clarify what chair he is going to be in. And I say, now respond back to the yes buts. I get the dialogue going. I'm not looking for resolution. I'm looking for clarification. And when he is in the aspiration chair, I might even say something like, wow, in this chair, Sue might even start to be quieting down. And instead of saying things like, geez, Charlie, just grow up, and you can say a lot of things you want to say in the voice of Sue, she might be being proud of you instead of thinking, dot, dot, dot. So it's a way of you sometimes releasing some of your countertransference when a person is doing two-chair work by giving it another voice from a different person, by what somebody might think or actually what they have said. Basically, we're making it safer by doing this two-chair work. we're laying the foundation for much of the future dialogues between Charlie and himself, which needs to happen, and not just between Charlie and Sue. So we have to work with the intrapsychic conflict within Charlie if we're going to get any traction on what goes on between the two of them. It's also very reassuring for Sue to see what Charlie's struggle is. So it's a twofer in what you get. So we're making it safe for them to expose their selfishness, and it helps us with our countertransference. And then the last thing I do is I say to Charlie, in the chair that you're in about restraint, it's also about self-discipline, which is remembering how you aspire to be in any given situation, and then you take action. This is the bridge, Charlie, between the primitive reactive emotional brain and our higher self.
Okay, so in the blog I sent out, there's a long example of two chair with some commentary by me that you can dig into more deeply. And throughout the year, we'll be looking at some two chair examples as well. But I want to move to teaching the partner that the self-absorption isn't personal. And this is really crucial because what it does is it enables the partner not to get caught up and not be so reactive in sessions, and gives you more room and space to work with the interpsychic issues. So I want to teach, and in fact, both partners tend to take a lot of things personally, but I'm going to focus specifically on the partner of the self-absorbed person. And, you know, I want to convey to them that what their partner is doing is not really about them. And I might do that by saying something like, if you were abducted by an alien and you suddenly disappeared, what do you think is the likelihood that Joe or Sarah would be the same with another partner? And usually folks will say, oh, yeah, or they get it, that they're not going to undergo just a massive personality change because they're with a different person. And so I'm teaching them the reality that what they think is about them is not really about them at all. And something that, like, you might say to them something like this. If, when your partner does something where you feel discounted or neglected, that's really going to sting. But the more you react in here from the part of you that feels the sting, the more focus I will have to put on calming things down between the two of you. And it's really not about you. It's a lot more about that self-focused part of him or her. They're forgetting about you in that moment. And those moments are going to become less frequent over time. So if you are able to say to yourself, what he or she just did is not about me, and hold on to an image of how you want to be as an effective partner, then you will be able to make more space for me to work with your spouse. And another thing along the lines of not taking things personally that I think is really helpful is for you as a therapist to really pay attention and notice when the spouse is beginning to move into not taking things personally, and give them a whole lot of strokes for that. So I actually put down some dialogue that occurred in a session that I had earlier this week, because it's an example of what I'm talking about. In this case, it was a wife who said, she was talking to me first, and she said, I'd really like him to think about what's going on that day. Perhaps I'm not feeling well. I wish he could just ask me about how I am doing. And so I said to her, and when he doesn't ask you how you're doing, do you think that says something about you or about him? And in that way, I'm testing her. By asking that, I'm testing how much he's personalizing what he's doing. And then she turned to her husband and she said, I'm realizing that it's about how you are oriented. You're oriented to think about yourself first. You almost always order first when we go to a restaurant. You talk often about what you want to buy for yourself. You don't really like to plan things for my birthday. That's just you. And I don't even feel mad when I say that. And I asked her how she felt, and she said, well, it's odd. I feel kind of shocked that I can say it so matter-of-factly. I'm summing up all my frustrations in one paragraph and surprised that I can say it without being angry. And so I gave her a whole lot of strokes and, you know, reiterated to her, you're really starting to realize when it's about him and that it would show up no matter who he was with. It isn't about you. So, and I really, particularly teaching people that it's not personal is something that you have to do a lot of at the beginning. It doesn't stick right away. But the more it begins to stick and the more they can get internal with themselves rather than being so reactive to the partner, just the freer and easier the therapy becomes. But at the beginning, the therapist can't be too lazy. I mean, you're going to have a lot of jumping in quickly to do when you see those moments of reactivity, those moments of personalization that go on. So I know we're getting short on time, and I want to shift to talking about the process of collaborative coaching. And this is best when you've already identified that internal split. And the couple and the partner who is self-absorbed has agreed to work on it. They've even maybe given themselves some of their own homework of how to start integrating that split. And you're talking to the couple about how they can change the pattern between them in real time when it's happening at home rather than sitting around stewing or not being resilient when that pattern shows up. And so so you have to get the consent that it is okay with each of them that they coach each other and that they see the coaching of each other as them being a team and trying to get out of the rigidity of the old pattern. And so if you get the consent that it's okay to do that kind of coaching, then you can start working with it in your office either by rewinding from a current fight or by bringing up an unfinished topic and teaching them how to coach each other. And I wanted to use an example just to show you the kinds of things that either Peter or I might say to them. And this is an example with a couple where he'll barge in no matter what she's working on or doing. He barges in and he wants her attention immediately and he wants her to attend to whatever he needs to attend to, and he doesn't recognize or doesn't pay attention to the fact that he's interrupting her at all. So that's the pattern they wanted to work on. And so we gave them a number of possible examples of how they might coach each other. So one of those examples was, honey, when you came in and just started talking to me, I felt like an it. I chose to stop doing what I was doing and to respond to you, even though it wasn't really convenient for me right then. Does what I'm saying make sense to you? So that's one example of how the wife in this case might approach it. Another way she might approach it is to say something along the lines of, honey, were you aware that when you just started talking that you were interrupting me? You didn't seem to be aware that I was busy doing whatever she was doing. And you can, when you give that example, you can say, you know, and it's important when you are coaching your partner and asking them if they're aware of it, that you say it with a smile on your face or, you know, you are able to communicate that I'm doing this out of a coaching position rather than an I've got you kind of position. So another example might be for the partner to say nothing at all when interrupted. And then usually the self-absorbed partner will get a little more intense and say, I'm talking to you. And the self-absorbed partner might say, I know, and I'm happy to respond to you when you approach me the new way rather than the old way. And then hopefully they can regroup and, again, give each other a whole lot of strokes when they are resilient in those moments and do it differently. Yeah.
See, just a quick thing is I will tell couples, you guys are already coaching each other. You're just doing a miserable job because every fight involves one person and the other one coaching the partner how to be, what to think, what to do, only you're doing it in a really miserable way. That's called a fight. So you're going to learn how to coach each other more effectively than the way you've been doing. I get permission by saying, now I need permission to coach you guys, which means I'm going to interrupt and redirect the traffic sometimes. And when I do that, there's going to be a part of you which sometimes will say, wait a minute, Pete, you don't have the whole story. You don't have all the facts. I need to tell the whole story. I need to be heard. And I'm going to say, well, the path you're on, you're about to hit a brick wall. Remember when you said I could coach you and interrupt? Well, this is one of those times. So you need permission. When I found that getting permission up front helps me make those kinds of things go a lot better instead of waiting till somebody just has to keep venting and they don't want me to butt in, but I got permission to butt in. Now, homework. This is great. I tell people that homework, they will get homework, but they got to do it. Otherwise, they're like a person who reads diet book after diet book without applying what they're learning, and then they complain that the diet books don't work. So homework is really, really crucial. And the homework can come in different forms. One form is the self-absorbed person does things unilaterally, intrapsychically to practice getting better at being patient and letting other people go first, literally. So sometimes I'll suggest homework like when you're at in a grocery store line, let somebody else go first. When you're at an intersection, let somebody else go first in front of you. Be polite. Do things for your partner, like wash their car, put gas in the tank, surprise them with the card, compliments. And here's that for just to really practice the self-restraint. I say, I want you to chew your food more slowly. It'll help you practice self-restraint. Do something like yoga where you have to stretch and make yourself exert yourself, and then hold those yoga poses for longer than you might, just so you can practice self-restraint, self-discipline over time. That'll start to pay off. And then I'll say one more thing. I'll give them the Jerry Seinfeld story, which is I'll say, here's a tip from Jerry Seinfeld that can have a dramatic effect on your marriage. And he was one of the most consistently successful comedians of his generation. At the height, he was making $298 million a year. He's kind of leveled off to making $8 or $9 million a year now. One time he was backstage and ready to go on, and a young comedian came up to him and said, do you have any advice for a young comedian? And Jerry Seinfeld, he thought, and he said, yeah, I do, actually. It's this. Get a calendar that has where you can see 365 days on it. Every day, I want you to start writing material, jokes, anecdotes, things that have potential to be stories. Every day, I want you to write something down. And every day that you write down, I want you to put an X on the calendar. And your goal is to don't break the chain of X's on the calendar. He didn't say anything about writing better jokes, doing better things. He just said, practice doing what will make you a better comedian every day. Your goal is not to break the chain. So I'll tell couples, your goal is to find something that is meaningful and significant, but also doable. And every day you do it, you put an X on the calendar. Your goal is not to break the chain. This tends to externalize the stress, and it puts it on the calendar instead of on the partner. So it's an easy way for them to remember not to break the chain.
So we've been talking, we've been inundating you with a lot of information, some of which has been very cognitive, and I don't want to end the call without putting some of the heart in it, because it is amazingly rewarding when you work with couples and are able to see the shifts begin to happen from the lack of other differentiation into a partner who can become much more aware of their spouse. And in the video that I sent you, I talked about a wife who described her self-absorption this way. She said, "I treated every battle like I needed to win. I thrived on instant gratification. I won in a bad way, and it didn't matter what happened to you or anyone else." And when I did the video, I didn't know that I was going to have such a wonderful experience with her as I had this week. But this couple was terminating, and she was crying and teary, and she said, "I have learned so much about what's wrong with being a bully." And with tears in her eyes, she said to her husband, "I truly, deeply want you to be happy." And that was just such an enormous shift from where she started. So I know we are at the end of our time. We promised to take some questions, and there are some that have gotten sent in by some of you writing them. And if those of you who are still on the call, we'll stay on a couple more minutes and go ahead and push star 2 if you have questions.
Or comments or reactions from the call.
And one of the questions that came in writing was, can you talk about the difference between self-absorption and narcissism? And I think one of the ways that I think about it is that it's a continuum, and self-absorption is the beginning of the continuum. A narcissistic personality disorder is farther along that continuum, and a sociopath is at the farthest end of that continuum. So that we, and particularly committed partnerships, make self-absorbed behavior show up when people are really have a difficult time incorporating another person, but it may not be as extreme or as intense
or as characterological
as the narcissist, or definitely not as the sociopath. So let's see. Somebody has their hand up, and I don't have your city. So go ahead, whoever put their hand up. Maybe Nancy or I guess that one went away. And I don't know, Jean, do you still have a question? Do you have a question? Your hand was up from before, so I don't know if you still do.
Oh, no, that was me commenting on people's questions.
Okay. So let's see. Looks like Deb.
Yeah, I have a comment that occurred to me as the two of you were talking that just reinforced something that I think is so critical, and that is going back and forth between the intrapsychic and the interpersonal, because by doing that, I mean, I'm going to say what's obvious, but by doing that, you can really balance out, you know, individually what they're doing and how they're reacting, and also helping the other person. I mean, that's a kind of differentiation, so that the partner realizes, wow, you know, my partner's reacting this way, but then also helping them together as a couple. I thought you guys did a really wonderful job of addressing that, particularly by talking about the intrapsychic conflict that each individual is going to have. In other words, that they want to change, but there's resistance to change. So I just wanted to comment on that. I thought that was really well done.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
Sure.
And let's see. So another question that got written in, Pete, I'll toss this one to you, was from Paul, and he said, can you address why when reflecting affect back to the self-absorbed partner, you often get met with a brick wall of noise and resistance?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, it's a good question. And partly it's how skillful we do it. If you reflect back the affect and say, it seems like there's a part of you that dot, dot, dot. So first of all, if you just say, is there a part of you that responds like this in that situation, it makes it easier for the client to say, okay, there is a part of me that does that. It's hard to deny it. And then if they say, okay, I do that, and then you say, well, that part of you that responds this way does so for good reasons. What do you think the reasons are that you might respond in that way? And they go, da, 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 da. And then you say, is there another part of you that aspires to be different in that situation? So I reflect back what they're saying. And if I do it skillfully enough, but sometimes, you know, I'm still going to hit a brick wall. But if I do it skillfully enough, they will acknowledge this is what they do. And then I, in a sense, I support it by saying that part of you has legitimate reasons for thinking, feeling, responding in this way. What do you think they are? And that way I'm not trying to change anything, but to bring forth that aspect that's hard for them often to talk about. And then you go to the aspiration. Is there another part of you that aspires to be different? And that seems to reduce a lot, but it certainly is not going to eliminate all the time that kind of defensiveness. But it's a good start in the limited amount of time we have to deal with it right now.
Okay, let me try again. The person whose city I don't have but has a hand up. Are you there?
Yeah, this is Kathy in San Marcel.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just wanted to get some clarification. By the way, I love this call. My question for clarification is just about the coaching part, where you get the partners to be able to coach each other.
Right.
I think I might have missed something there, and I'm just wondering, like, when do you do that, and how well does that go, and how much work does a couple have to do before you can send them off to do that? Because that sounded pretty advanced to me.
Yeah, so good call on your part. It's, you know, first of all, you wouldn't do that until there's a lot of acceptance of the self-absorbed, by the self-absorbed partner, that they are invested in changing it, kind of like in the dialogue that I sent in those blogs where the guy was really moving into more acceptance of changing that part of himself. Then you can bring it up in the office in terms of how much is it okay for you, your wife, to coach you at home. Is that okay when she experiences those moments where, uh-oh, you step back into something that feels very discounting or disrespectful? Is there a way that she can coach you that you realize that she's doing it not to get you? She's not being a parent or she's not criticizing you, but she's really doing it to support an immediate change. And then you can, you know, you're going to do a few in the office before you would ever send them home to do it at home, because you want it to be successful rather than a failure. So it's farther along in the therapy.
That's great. And just if I can ask one more, or when you were talking about the two chair, or exposing the split and using the two chair, and then the therapist's job being easier from that point on, that sounded like you would do the two chair pretty early on then with this type of couple. And I just want to clarify, is that correct?
Again, it depends. It depends if
on receptivity.
Yeah. See,
the
absolute key to doing exquisite two-chair work is being able to clearly identify the split in the client before you actually start doing it, or believe the therapist believes that the client can readily access the yes but part of themselves. Almost always when two-chair work goes awry, it's because the therapist and or the client is unclear about what the split is. So it has to be really, I'm glad you're asking this, it has to be defined clearly ahead of time. Because of time constraints on this call, you know, I glossed over some of the details, but before even doing a split with a two-chair with somebody, I'd say, so there, is there a part of you responds this way, and it does so for self-protective reasons. Does that make sense? And they go, yeah. And a part of you is reluctant to go along with what your spouse says about changing, yeah. And then I say, is there another part of you that, in spite of that, even a small part, which says it might be a good idea to look for higher ground, come from your higher self? And if they say, yeah, but they're hesitant, I'll say, well, what might that be before I have them actually move into another chair? Because I want to find out how strong that and how strong and clear that split is. The more clarity of the split, the more success you're going to have guiding that dialogue back and forth.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. So a nice segue between the two-chair work and the coaching is to make use of the engagement continuum that I gave you to print out, and it's with the second video. And that's a way to help a self-absorbed partner identify changes that they do want to make. And so then those can be integrated into the coaching. I wanted Douglas to take yours, and then we'll wrap up after that.
I just had a question about working with the couple and then working with the individuals in a situation like this. With a self-absorbed partner, there's, at least I feel, a tendency at times to meet individually.
Oh, good point.
And yet they often also feel like, hey, what about her, or what about him? it's a tricky edge, and I'm wondering how you work with that.
That's a total case-by-case situation. I'm working with one guy, self-acknowledged, self-absorbed. I work with him. I start seeing them together like the first five or six times, and then I would work with him about three or four times individually, see them together, work with her individually a couple times, see them together. Now, I give you that as an example of being really flexible. And right. I'll tell them, here's why I suggest I work individually with you and with you, and here's why I think it's a good idea why we get back together. It goes back to the notion of explaining to people what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Good, right, okay.
I have a couple right now with these issues, too, that I'm seeing where I actually see them. Most of the time I see them three times a month as a couple, and in the alternate week I see them both individually. But then there are times when I'll say, I would love next week to be able to do an individual session with each of you before we come back together. So it's just, it occurs over time as you see what you think is going to be most effective.
Yeah, I like the sort of transparency of it, that you're really sharing with them you're thinking about it. It's something that for some reason I think I keep to myself more than is useful. I think
you have a lot of company in that approach.
Yeah.
Here's a really small example. It's like when you're at the dentist office and a dentist will say, okay,
right.
I'm going to do this and it's going to hurt. Well, at least they've warned you and they have some empathy for what's going to happen.
Right.
That's a good model for talking with couples.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Okay, so we are going to...
Let me just take 30 seconds if anybody else has any comments.
Well, I'm going to open it all the lines, Pete.
Oh, okay, thanks. Oh, forget what I just said.
So, Pete and I, thank you for being with us today. We're going to open up all the lines, so it gives anybody a chance to just say any last things you want to say as you're leaving. And again, throughout the year in the cases, we'll be looking at these issues in an ongoing way, too. So,
Can you remind me how to raise your hand?
Sure. It's star 2.
Okay, thank you. I missed it somehow.
But along the basic thing, which is essentially
So any comments from anybody as you say goodbye?
Thank you. Wonderful.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Great call.
I can absorb that.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I loved all the different steps, all the different statements
reality.
Is like, I want to go back and make a lot of notes and just have all that there because these couples are very difficult.
And one thing you all want to look out for, too, is Nancy St. John does a wonderful job summarizing the calls. It will probably take a couple weeks till it's up, but you can look for her summary as well.
Oh, great.
And where do you look for that?
That's on the same page as the call is on. It'll get posted. And there's a comment section on that page, so feel free to post comments after today as well.
Can I just ask a question?
Pardon me?
Can I ask one last question?
Sure.
Okay. I spoke at the beginning with this couple where the husband was pretty self-absorbed. And so I listened all the talk, and I was wondering, for the second session, if you have anything in particular that you would do to address his attitude or his, you know, response, his way of interacting in a defensive way and attacking his wife.
Well, I tell you what, that's a great question, and it will only take about 25 to 35 to 45 minutes to respond to, because it's such a decision tree, you know. So there's not – here's what's great about couples therapy. It's not formulaic. And so it this is going to be an answer that's going to annoy a part of you maybe. It all depends what you do the next session on what happened the first one.
Well, and just following up a little on what we've been talking about today, though, you could say to him, you know, is there a part of you that would like to have a better relationship with your wife? And if he says yes, which he probably will, at least acknowledge some part of him would like that, then you can ask him to reflect on what he imagines would be required of him as well as what would be required of her. And you can tell him, I'm going to ask her the same question, too. So what you're doing is you're looking, I mean, that's a very diagnostic question to begin to see how much awareness does he have of how he operates in the relationship, how much awareness does he have of what might make a difference. It tells you where you are. And because you're new in the course, you are going to get so much in the lessons in the weeks ahead about how to set a good trajectory. One thing I suggest that everybody listen to is Pete did a call in September of 2012 on rethinking first sessions. And there's a lot in there that would apply to a second session because there's no way you will have, you know, done all that he talks about in there as well. So that would be a really good resource to look
at. Oh, that's a really good answer. And because it kind of sets the stage for a lot of the therapy. And when Ellen was talking, I'll give you a little more specific response to your question, which is often I will say to a couple when they come in, what is it that you would like to have happen today? I'm not guarantee it can happen, but what would you like to have happen today? It's striking a balance between leading and following. By asking that question, I'm following. Sometimes I take a leading, like when I was saying, I set it up for the two-chair work and what their tasks are. Sometimes I follow by saying, what would you like to have happen today? That would make it worthwhile for coming in. And that gives me a kind of a peek into their evolution, their progress, where they're still stuck, et cetera, et cetera. But Ellen's thing about rethinking the first session is a really good call because it kind of sets the trajectory or potentially sets the trajectory for weeks to follow after the first session.
Mm-hmm. So are you talking about setting up goals today, like focusing on that, maybe asking them?
That's part of it, but you got to listen to it because it's not just – it's setting the context for how they establish
a goal. Yeah, I have listened to that one, actually.
Yeah. Okay. It'll get clearer as you listen to it.
He's talking about creating the sense of teamwork, creating the sense that they're in this together, and then how you move into clearer goals, clearer direction.
That session about rethinking the first session also applies to couples you currently have in your practice. So you can use much of that same, I go in there about how you can use that same model for couples that you're currently working with to help get refocused, reset, reorganized.
Oh, that's great.
Good.
Okay, any other comments? As you all say goodbye.
Thank you.
All righty.
Thank you very much.
Very helpful.
All right. Thanks for your involvement, participation, questions, and activity. You guys are in for a great year with Ellen, and I appreciate Ellen making room for me to participate in the call today as well. So thanks, Ellen.
You're welcome.
All right.
Always fun. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'll talk to you all next week.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.